turn this on.
We just missed the sarcastic comment that I made. Do you have the Baptist faith and message in front of you? Have you looked at the words that it says about cooperation?
Yes.
What comes right after that?
A
list of scripture verses. Where might we look to find something that speaks? You might start by reading those verses. Doesn't that sound like a good idea? I'm just checking to see if you're catching on to the way this thing is constructed. Yes? No? Doesn't that seem like a good idea? Yeah. Okay. So, where do the scriptures that are listed, where do they take you first? Where in the Old Testament? Ezra and, verse 2 is what I mean, Nehemiah. Everybody still okay? Now, just to let you know, the Old Testament along in this part has some interesting titles for the books. There is, after Joshua and Judges, 1 Samuel, followed by 1 Kings, followed by 1 Chronicles, and then
2 Chronicles.
And then we have
Ezra
and Nehemiah are a paired set of books, just like 1 and 2. They just have two different names, because in this one, two different people become very prominent, and prominent at about the same time, and one focuses more on one, and the other focuses more on the other. But really, what they're doing and when they're doing it all overlaps. So I want you to think of this as 1st Ezra Nehemiah and 2nd Ezra Nehemiah. Or you could do what I've done once or twice, Ezra Nehemiah and Nehemiah Ezra. That works as well. You still have the same thing out front. So, what was the time? What's the setting for those two books? 7.5 years ago we went through this, so all of you should still remember, right? They are rebuilding Jerusalem. Rebuilding Jerusalem after what? After the exile. What exile? Babylonian exile. Okay? Where is this in relation to Jesus' birth? Several hundred years before. 400, 500, 600, 700 years before. I think about 4, but I don't want to be dogmatic about that because I'm not sure. But several hundred years before Jesus came. Where is it in relationship to David and Solomon? Long after, because it was the period of the kings that ended with Babylon taking over. Assyria came in and took over the northern kingdom first. Somewhat later, Babylon came in and took over the southern kingdom. That was northern southern kingdom because the kingdoms had split. And now people had all gone into exile. And what happened was, about 70 years later, there was a king who said, well, let me stop for a second. Some of you have been to church this morning, right? What was the subject of the past? Huh? Oh, yes. Excellent. And the subject was focused on what people? Vashti? Mordecai? Esther? Thank you. And a king. King of what? King of Persia, we think. Because by this time, the Babylonian Empire has fallen and Persia has taken over. And this is the people still in exile. Still in exile. We're not absolutely certain of when that happened in comparison to Ezra and Nehemiah. A lot of people think it happened a little bit later. There were some Jewish people who were back in Palestine, back in the Holy Land, back in the Promised Land. And others were still in Persia, which had taken over the Babylonian Empire by this time. So the story this morning took place among the Jews still in exile. But our story in Ezra and Nehemiah takes place in the setting of the people returning to rebuild the country. And where I want to take you first is I want to take you back to Ezra chapter 1. So if you can find anything in the Old Testament that says 1 and 2, go to the next book. Find anything that says 1 and 2, look in the next book. Book is Ezra, chapter 1, verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken through Jeremiah, the Lord roused the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, to issue a proclamation and to have it publicly displayed throughout his kingdom. Everybody read that? I want you to do something just for fun, would you? Back up a book. Don't turn a page, except one page. You shouldn't have to turn more than one or two pages. Just turn back one page to the very last of 2 Chronicles. And I want you to read verse 22 in the last chapter, which I think is 36. You ready? In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord through Jeremiah, the Lord roused the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, to issue a proclamation and to have it publicly displayed throughout his kingdom. Looks the same to me. Did it look the same to you? Okay? When you recognize that these are books of history, there's not a break at the end of the ones and twos, but the history sort of goes on. And what's happened is that back up one verse, verse 21, is Jeremiah's prophecy. Verse 21, to fulfill the Lord's prophecy through Jeremiah, quote, until the country has paid off its Sabbaths, it will lie fallow for all the days of its desolation until the 70 years are complete. So they've been in captivity for 70 years. As generations go, that would be somewhere between 3 and 4 and 5 generations. And now the king is ordered to decree. Why did the king put this decree out? Read verse 22. My translation says God roused the spirit of the king. What does yours say? Move the heart. How should we see that as having happened? Here's several possibilities. One is, he suddenly finds himself, the king does, thinking about what the Babylonians had done to Jerusalem. And thinking about what he knows about the God of the Jewish people. And thinking about his own place in history and his own mortality. And he may have been a private seeker. He may have said to himself, you know, what they did wasn't just wrong, it was awful. Maybe they shouldn't have destroyed that temple. And I have this picture that he started thinking about it, he couldn't stop. Maybe he had dreams in the night. Maybe over and over. Visions during the day. But somehow his mind and his heart was drawn to this. And so here's the proclamation. It's a little bit longer in my copy of Ezra. It's a little bit shorter at the tail end of 2 Chronicles. So let's read the book of Ezra, verse 2. Cyrus, king of Persia, says this, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has appointed me to build him a temple in Jerusalem and Judah. Whoever among you belongs to the full tally of his people, may his God be with him, let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, who is the God in Jerusalem. And let each survivor, wherever he lives, be helped by the people of his locality with silver, gold, equipment, and riding beasts, as well as voluntary offerings for the temple of God, which is in Jerusalem. That's pretty strong stuff coming from a king who isn't part of God's people. Whoever among you belongs to the full tally of his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem. Up to Jerusalem. Which way was Jerusalem from where Cyrus was?
West.
It was west. I thought it said up. I just want to make sure everybody understands that. Up is not north. Down is not south. Up is higher, down is lower. People walked in those days, and if you were going up, you felt like you were going up. Okay. Now, look at verse 5, because here's where it starts to get exciting, I think. Then the heads of the families of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, Judah and Benjamin, that identifies the southern kingdom, In fact, all whose spirit has been roused by God. In my translation, it's the same words that was used for the king. Prepared to go and rebuild the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. And all their neighbors gave them every kind of help. Silver, gold, equipment, riding beasts, and valuable presents in addition to their voluntary offerings. Now, what had you just heard? A crisis or an opportunity or whatever term you might want to give to it has come for a task to be accomplished. And out of the people who might accomplish that task, two groups emerge. Now, there might be a lot of other people that don't choose to belong to either of those two groups, but two groups emerge. What are those two groups? Can you see them? The ones who go and the ones who stay. But it's not just the ones who stay. The two groups that I'm talking about, the ones that emerge as people who are in obedience to and doing what the king in this case has been prompted by God to order, the ones who go and the ones who stay, but what?
Support the ones who go.
Anybody see any parallels to what the Baptist faith and message is talking about in cooperation? Sure sounds like not just missions, sounds like a lot of stuff we do. In fact, it sounds like a whole lot. Almost anything the church does in the way of service activities of some kind, prison ministry, ESL, and those two are now overlapped. There's some ESL going on in the prisons now. Habitat for Humanity, work in some of the apartment complexes and mobile home parks, the homework clubs. You know, there's always resources you need to do those things. Look at our own class this morning. We've got an opportunity for service. And what are we doing? We're beginning to make some organization. And what were Allison's words just a few minutes ago? Did you hear them? Some of you will be able to come and help. Others won't be able to come and help but still want to have a part. Here's how you can have a part. Give some money to help pay the cost. Same principle. Some will be moved to go. Some will be moved to stay but help. And then a whole bunch won't be moved at all. God is working with those first two groups. The ones who are moved to go and the ones who are not moved to go but who are moved to help. I put this list on the board and I hope you'll keep adding to it. I hope you'll keep up with this for the next week or two, for the next, how long is it going to be, months. I know Sam Lloyd. He's a fellow that works in our physical plant. And he and a buddy of his have been moving most of the stuff that's had to be moved in my building reconstruction for the last year. We've gotten to know him pretty well. He's on the hallway with a dolly. He's out in the parking lot with a truck. He's moving stuff here and there. And always, without exception, with this sweet, wonderful spirit. And I saw his partner in crime, the younger guy that's been working with him, and Sam wasn't with him. I said, "Where's Sam?" He says, "Sam's gone to New Orleans. He left at 4:30 yesterday morning, 40 people. I said men, but I think I don't know that for sure. 40 people from Nottoway County have gone. Others are going to go, and you see them, the list starting to grow here. I'm not going, but I can pray. I'm not going, but I can give. And you can do one or the other." That's the way cooperation works. Sometimes cooperation is at its most beautiful when there's something very deep and tragic going on like this is. Sometimes cooperation is most impressive when nobody is seeing it happen. And it still goes on. The faithfulness over a period of time is state of task. Now, I want to move you a little bit further. What were the tasks that had to be done? The king says, go back and rebuild the temple at Jerusalem. So what has to be done to accomplish this?
You have to have insurance.
Okay. Yeah, but what will you accomplish when you have finished some of that work? These are details of the work that have to be done. But what is it you're doing? They're rebuilding a temple, so that's one. We can go ahead and put that on the list. They're building a structure. Okay. Anything else have to be done? They better rebuild a community structure around it, because if there's a temple and nobody to worship there, that's going to be not worth a whole lot. And so building that means rebuilding an entire community, rebuilding Jerusalem. And to rebuild Jerusalem requires rebuilding the temple, the heart of Jerusalem, rebuilding the infrastructure around it, homes and so forth, rebuilding the farms and the sources of food and the sources of other things, and rebuilding the safety net. Now, the two things that emerge out of this pair of books is the rebuilding of the temple, which emerges early, and then the rebuilding of the walls, which comes late. Ezra, a little bit more involved with the building of the temple. Nehemiah, more involved with the building of the walls. Now, there's all kinds of other things being built as well. When you look at the book of Nehemiah the right way, we aren't going to look at it the right way this morning because doing that would take all morning. When you look at it the right way, what you find is a powerful manual of leadership. Let me just show you a couple of little things to help you see this. Take a look at the book of Nehemiah. That's the next book, if you sort of picked up on what I'm saying here, Ezra and then Nehemiah. Verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, son of a certain person. I will tell you, if you pronounce it as if you know how, people will think you do. But I decided I wouldn't try that one. It happened in the month of Chezlev in the 20th year while I was in the citadel of Susa, that's the capital, still Persia, that Hanani, one of my brothers, arrived with some men from Judah. Now, that means his brother was one of those who went. That means Nehemiah was one of those who didn't go, back in our earlier thing. I asked them about the Jews, those who had escaped and those who survived captivity, and about Jerusalem. They replied, the survivors remaining there in the province since the captivity are in a very bad and demoralized condition. The walls of Jerusalem are in ruins, and its gates have been burned down. Let me try that again with a paraphrase. Will you permit me? Tell me about New Orleans. The survivors remaining there since the devastation of the hurricane are in a very bad and demoralized condition. The infrastructure of the town is in ruins, and its entrance and exit ports are destroyed. What was Nehemiah's reaction? He sat down and wept. Any of you find yourselves crying this week? There are some hard things going on right now. I said, Lord God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God who keeps a covenant of faithful love with those who love him and obey his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to listen to your servant's prayer. And he prays. Powerful prayer. But I want you to look at the last sentence of this chapter. How does it end? I was cupbearer to the king. Go to church this morning? If you haven't been yet, you've got something in store, but you can't participate quite as well in what I'm about to do. What was the subject? Who was the central figure? We named several. Who was the central figure that he spent time with? And what was it that happened with Esther? What was the sentence Mordecai said to her? Who knows? But that you have come to the position you enjoy for such a time as this. What does it mean to be the cupbearer to the king?
Didn't he taste the food that was poisoned?
People might want to kill the king for poison. This is the person who supplied the food to the king. You don't get much more trusted than that. May not have been a particularly high official in terms of all the responsibility he had, but boy was he high in terms of influence. However, we are still talking about the same kind of king that we were talking about this morning. When Esther walked in, I have a Bible. I got my Bible, I think, when I was fifth grade. And in that Bible, It had some pictures. Did you get a Bible when you were a child? Did it have pictures in it? Do you remember some of those pictures about as vividly as you remember anything from your childhood? I remember one. It's a picture of the moment Esther walked in. I can tell you what the king's scepter looked like because it said in that story he held his scepter out to her. If he had not done that, she would have been hauled out of the room and executed without an order given. What's the job of the cupbearer? Yes, it's to protect the husband. But what else? It is to be happy in his presence. It is to be happy and positive in his presence. And Nehemiah walked in crying. You're not allowed to depress the king. That's execution, too. Very, very similar circumstances to Esther. Very similar circumstances. And the king either says, "What are you? Take this guy out here and kill him." Or the king says, "What's wrong, my friend?" And Nehemiah had the experience of having the king say, "What's wrong, my friend?" And Nehemiah poured out his heart. And the king said, "Why don't you go and fix all of that? And let me give you a letter that has my signature on it that basically is a blank check." And Nehemiah goes. And the story that follows is the story of Nehemiah stepping in. Let's look at just a couple of things. Verse 8. "Also I was given an order for the keeper of the king's forest to supply me with timber for the beams of the gate of the citadel of the temple, for the city walls, and for the house which I was to occupy. This the king granted me because of the kindly hand of my God was over me." He's already making provisions for the supplies he needs. A good leader will do that. Verse 11, "And so I reached Jerusalem. I had not been there. After I'd been there 3 days, I got up during the night with a few other men. I had not told anyone what my God had inspired me to do. I took no animal with me other than my own mount, and under the cover of darkness, I went out through the valley gate, through the dragon's fountain, as far as the dung gate, and examined the wall of Jerusalem where it was broken down and its gates burned out." What's he doing? A good leader figures out what the problem is and what steps might be done to take it. We're running short on time, so I want to take you to what I think is the heart of our issue for this morning. Because he comes back, inspires the people to build. But if you take a look, something real interesting happens. Let's start in the middle of this rather than at the first. Take a look at verse 9. I'm sorry, I've just moved to chapter 3. Okay. And the verse I want to take you to is verse 10. But let's read verse 9 first, because we sort of pick up the rhythm of what's gone before. We pick up the rhythm of what's going to still be going on after. But verse 10 brings out the heart of what we're talking about. "Next to them," verse 9 says, "the repairs were carried out by Raphael, the son of who was head of one half of the district of Jerusalem. Next to them, Jediah, son of..." Sounds like Hump, doesn't it, in my translation? "Carried out repairs where?" Opposite his own house. When you see that phrase and go back and read everything else, what's happening is wherever you lived in the city, you started to have responsibility for the walls that are in that section. If you lived over here, you work in there. And what's happening is cooperation involves self-interest as well as selfless interest. Selfish interest. The two sort of combined. Oh my goodness, I can't go any further down that road. Let me move to the thing I wanted to try to get to, and maybe we can spend 4 minutes on it. What's the basis for cooperation in the Christian community? What's the basis, the foundation principles? Why is it that cooperating with other Christians is a good thing to do?
Okay, give me one.
Love.
For what? For God and each other and
two greatest, what's the greatest commandment in the law? And he gave two as his answer. What were those two? Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. That takes care of this one, and that takes care of this one. John 15, Jesus is in the upper room. He looks at his disciples and he says, I'm giving you a new commandment. I want you to hear what I think he was saying. I told these other people there were two in the law, but there's a third one I'm giving you. And when you work with three. And what's that? Love one another. What's the basis of cooperation? Our love for God, our love for each other, and our love for others. What else?
Desire.
Where does that desire come from?
It comes from your heart, from God.
Okay. I'm going to word it this way. Our call to service. God calls each one of his children to service in some capacity. In our church, we try to help you find out what your passions are, what your gifts are, your spiritual gifts, and then we try to help you find some place to express that in service. What else? Help me understand what that means.
Be able to work and listen to others. Work with and listen to others.
Okay. I'm going to leave that with blank because I don't know how to word that. I think you're on to something, but I don't know how to word that. Let me take you to another one. Did you watch TV this week?
Yes.
What did you see?
It's organization.
No. Not if you've got a heart like Jesus. That's not what you saw. You did not see chaos. You did not see destruction. You saw need. You saw need. Right? Nehemiah's brother comes to visit. How's it going in Jerusalem? What did his brothers say? At that moment, Nehemiah did not know. And his brother started telling him. What did Nehemiah see? He saw the need. That's what he saw. And I think that's...
the need for people, I think, is a basis for this.
What else?
I've got a way of wording your fellowship.
That's the one I've written down. Was the fact that when I start to work with some of you or when you start to work from each other, all of a sudden the fellowship that we have deepens because we're sharing a common path. And if that's what you were talking about, I didn't want to put the words in your mouth, but the interaction that we have with each other deepens our fellowship. Both with each other and with our work. And some of you have had that. Anything else?
You get better results by working together.
Yeah, I got a 4 on that. When I was sitting there thinking about that. There's an economy of scale if you work together. We can begin to specialize. One that's good at this can do that, and this isn't left undone. That we can do more together than we can alone. So there's a lot of things that go down there, but just... more done by group than individuals. And lots of different variations on that. Anything else? What did you guys organize, spend time organizing this morning? The Energy Unite High School. Okay. Is this first year we've done this?
No.
Second year we've done that, right? What happened today that didn't happen last year? The team has said, you know, there's something there we'd like to go see. And from what I hear, I'm not sure of this. Some of you may have heard this better. I think the impetus for this came from the kids and not from the coach. But I'm hearing a piece of that. That it's sort of the kids and the coaches together. Not the coaches saying, hey, it'd be a good thing to do. Because... if that had been the emphasis, they'd have done this last year. But it's a matter of
and what I wrote down was the opening of doors through our service.
Don't you think it's also our way of being Christian loving? it's a mission trip to New Orleans, or a mission trip to international field, or a mission trip to a hospital, it's the legacy, and it's the leader.
What was the name of our campaign?
How legacy continues.
Why did we say it that way?
Because we hope it goes on and on and on.
Because a lot of what we enjoy right here came from faithful people like Lois, and faithful people like Jamie, and faithful people like Jim, who a long time ago sacrificed to make things happen. We are now benefiting from that. And if we do our part, we can leave a legacy for those that follow us. That's part of the principle that's here. Why might someone not work in cooperation with others in the body? We're going to quit with this and we're only going to take a minute. Why might somebody not work? We don't have much time, so let me offer some. Selfishness might be one. I don't think those are the big ones. The big one might be guilt. God can't use somebody like me. You don't know what I've done. I remember hearing somebody say more than once. And I'm thinking of a very specific person when I say that. Grief can immobilize somebody. Events of life that simply can't be explained. There's going to be some people coming out of New Orleans that are going to be paralyzed for any kind of service, and yet they've been serving wonderfully before this moment. But what has happened down there is going to be so hard to overcome to get them back to where they served. Now, what else? Confusion. If you read through Nehemiah and if you read through Esther, it's the criticism from the sidelines that stopped this project over and over again. Watch for Sanballat. He's the bad guy. Hiss when you see that name, Sanballat. It's simply a fact. You don't get encouragement to go down this road from the world we live in. There's a verse in Second Corinthians. You want to look it up. It's in chapter 8 and verse 13. And it says, it's not that you should give and impoverish yourself in the process. God has blessed you. Give out of the blessings. And the day may come when today your surplus is supplying the needs of some people. It may be that in the future the surplus of somebody else may supply yours. People in New Orleans who never thought they would be in a position of needing help suddenly need help desperately. Hopefully, that help will be there.
May I have one more thing?
Very, very quickly.
Had an experience of having someone help you in a similar situation that you want to help?
Some of those people who came to Virginia during Isabel from South Carolina, why are you here? Answer, because Virginia Baptist came to South Carolina when Hugo hit. That's enough for one day. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, teach us that you have called us, but even more, you have called us into community with others you have called. Teach us how vitally important it is to learn how to work with each other, to tolerate the quirks and eccentricities, and to celebrate in the differences, so that together we can do things that we couldn't ever do alone, and that we can do things with you that even together with others we would never have accomplished if your presence and your power had not been part of it. Be with those who are in need. Be with those who are responding to the need. Make yourself manifest to all. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.